This is my first year being Mashkiach in Torah Traga. And at the beginning of the summer, I was talking to different Mashkichim and different Rebbeim and different yeshivas for ideas when preparing shmuzes, when preparing talks. You know, what do you have to add to it to make it better? So I actually heard from two or three people when I spoke to them, they said, you have to listen to TED Talks. What's TED Talks? Oh, it's just something on the internet where you have different inspirational speakers. They're all saying inspiring stories that happened to them, thoughts that they have. So I was able to print out a bunch of scripts of what people spoke about in TED Talks. And the truth is, I think after you learn a lot of Torah, it takes more to inspire you than it would take somebody that's not exposed to Torah. So a lot of it wasn't as inspiring to me, but I did find, until I found something inspiring, I had to type in, they have like a search box, I type in the word death. But maybe when Garim speak about death, it gets more inspirational. So then actually very inspiring things came up. And I want to tell you a speech that I read by somebody that spoke in TED Talks. It was a guy, he said he's been working in the ER for many decades. And it would commonly happen in a week that he would meet a lot of people that he just wasn't going to be able to save, and he knew that they were going to be dying. It's something called impending doom syndrome, where you know they're going to die. Called impending doom syndrome. It's in the medical work. And he said, they don't give you rules of what do you tell the patient when they're in this impending doom, when you know they're going to die in the next half an hour. How do you deal with such a patient? What, do you tell them? Do you not tell them? So every ER member makes up the rules for themselves and decides what they want to do. So he said, for the first many years that I was doing this, I didn't want to tell them they were going to die. I don't want to freak them out. I don't want to make them upset with me. I don't want to make them nervous and start fighting and like pulling wires or whatever. So I just didn't tell them. Then one time, somebody was brought in. He was in a motorcycle accident. And I knew I couldn't save his life and he was going to be dying in the next 20 minutes. And he noticed something was very serious and he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, "Doctor, am I going to die?" Whatever it was that inside of him decided I'm going to tell him the truth. And I said, "Yes, you're going to die." And he said, and I noticed on him that when I told him that, he suddenly got very calm and very contemplative. He started to think to himself. And he had a very meaningful last bunch of minutes of his life, whatever he was thinking in his mind. And I decided from then on I'm going to completely change what I do. And I'm going to start to tell people when I know that they're going to die that you have only a few more minutes to live. You only have a few more 10 minutes to live. And I've been doing that for the last few decades, he says, and I noticed that there are three reactions that everybody has when I tell them this. We're now only going to talk about one of them, the first initial reaction that he said most of the people would have when you would tell them you have a few more minutes to live. He said right away, without any thinking at all of a sudden a lot of them would immediately open up to him, be very close to him, and tell them, "I wish I would have done blank." There was one old man, he was already 80-something, 90-something, and his whole life to work things out. And he's 88, whatever it is, and he says, you have, 10, 20 minutes to live. And he looked at him and said, "I wish I wasn't so selfish with my time. I wish I spent more time with my kids, more time with my grandchildren." There was another woman he remembers trying to pull her out of a car, and he knew she was going to die before he saved her. And she said to him, "I didn't do with my life what I planned on doing. Am I going to die?" I listened to another talk that came up of a guy that he was in a plane that was crashing. You don't usually get to hear from a guy that was in a plane that was crashing, that crashes, and he gets to talk about it afterwards. But this one crashed in the Hudson River, and I think everybody made it out alive. And he describes what he felt like in those few minutes where he was sure that he was going to die. And he said that the moment the plane started going down, they knew they were crashing and they had the oxygen masks, he said he right away said, "I wish I didn't yell at my kids so much. I wish I didn't yell at my wife so much. I wish I wasn't angry all the time." And he immediately, it wasn't like he had time to think. He didn't have to do like a cheshbon and nefesh. He didn't have to think to himself, it immediately just popped right out of his head. All those things that he just never got around to being better at, that he wanted to do, that he never did. And now that he's about to die, it's coming to his head that he wished he did differently. This doesn't only happen at the moment that somebody thinks they're going to die or as they're dying. Lahavdil, in a big way. So I personally have been teaching here, I think, 14 years. A lot of the Rebbeim here have been here for many years. At the end of every single year, as it starts to sink into the guys in the last day or two of yeshiva that it's actually over, suddenly guys start to sometimes break down or open up and say, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. Sometimes they only realize when they pack up their room, their suitcases are full, and they see the room looks like it looked like with the day they moved in. All of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, yeshiva's over. And then they start to come out with all the things that they wish they would have done, that they had planned on doing, and like, where did all that time go? But how does that happen? It doesn't make any sense. It's on the top of a person's head. Things that they planned on, they expected they were going to do, they really wanted to, they're very emotionally connected to that desire, and yet suddenly it's only at the end when it's too late or it's over that it suddenly comes out of the person. What is it that makes that phenomenon happen? And it happens to all of us. I'm going to ask another question. Why do people get married? Well, yeah, a man or woman, they meet each other, they love each other, and they want to spend the rest of their life together. Spend the rest of your life together. Why do you think I'm married? Spend the rest of your life together. Find a house and spend the rest of your life together. Why do you have to get married? Why does it need to be something formal like that? If you look through Maseches Kiddushin, it describes how a man is mekadesh a woman and how a couple's married. And you don't find anywhere that it talks about love. It's very contractual. It's very much of an agreement, very much of a commitment between the husband and the wife. They actually learn out how to be mekadesh a woman from how you buy a grave. The way Avram Avinu bought Stay Ephron and bought a grave to bury his wife in, that's how we learn out how a husband is mekadesh his wife. It's very dry, very unemotional. Why is it that people get married? Why don't they just stay together? You love each other, stay together. Why do you have to make an agreement and a formality about it? And the reason is because human beings understand what one of their greatest challenges are, what their one of their greatest weaknesses are, is that a human being can't trust himself. A human being doesn't always do, and often doesn't do, the things that they want to do and that they plan on doing. And a human being doesn't always feel the same way. One day he's feeling something, one day he's not feeling something, and then sometimes the old feeling comes back and the new feeling comes in. If somebody says, I want to be your best friend, let's live together and have kids, that's not enough. I need to know you're never going to change your mind. I need to know this is done, this is for sure, this is a commitment. It has to happen. It can't be going to leave me in the middle because I don't want to keep on switching wives every couple of years, and I want to live with my children. So I need a commitment. And that's what the whole thing needs to be based on. And that's one of the ways that human beings deal with our weakness of when we decide things based on feelings, it changes all the time. We can't trust ourselves. But if we make a commitment, we tie ourselves to something, we bind ourselves to something, and we make it in a way that it can't be any other way, to make sure that what we want to happen will happen, then we guarantee that it will happen. We use our free will to take away our daily free will to make sure that what we want to happen will end up happening. Because if every day we keep on choosing and re-choosing, our life will always be going up and down. We won't ever accomplish anything. But if we take what we want and we bind ourselves to it, and we try to take our choice out of it, we commit ourselves. So you don't keep on deciding every day, do I want to be married to her? Is this going to be my wife? This is you're making a life together. Done. That decision was made. Now we'll move further. When a person has a goal, something they want to accomplish, they need to get to it. They need to make a commitment that binds themselves to it, a schedule that they stay committed to in a way that they're not going to break because they know that there's going to be a lot of things trying to stop them from it. There's another similar, equally difficult human weakness, and that is we trick ourselves with the concepts of now and later. It's such a comforting thing to be able to say to ourselves, I'll do it later. Because when you say, I'll do it later, so you feel great. The best situation is you can do it later. Because you're going to do it. So I mean, great. You can do it. And you don't have to do it now. And it's hard. And you don't want to do it now. But now I'm okay because I'm going to do it later. So we do that with everything. We do that with our tests, a lot of us. We do that with reports. We do it with a lot of things that are hard for us. And they're important to us. We don't want to say, I'm not going to do it. We don't want to give up on that because we do want to do it. But it's hard. So I'm going to do it later. And later now allows you to still be happy and good, not feel uncomfortable, and also not have to do it. And that later keeps getting later and later and later and later. And then you could be an old man in front of the ER and there's Hashem, and then all of a sudden, oh, but I never got around to it. Or as that later starts to limit your options, because you realize, wow, like now I'm 20, now I'm 30, now I'm 40, or now it's September, now it's December, and now it's March. So all of a sudden, I'm like, wait, I don't think I can get to be like that. So we start to change what our goals are and make them smaller and smaller and smaller, because the later had to make it smaller and smaller and smaller. And therefore, the greatest strength we can give to ourselves in life, not just your year in Israel, but the greatest strength that we can acquire for ourselves in life is to fight that word later. Fight that decision later and do it now. Mitzvah haba liyadcha atach mitzena. Mitzvah comes to your hand, don't let it turn into chametz. To become chametz, you let the dough rise 18 minutes. Don't let time go by, do it now. Because the Yetzer, the way the Yetzer fights us, is it will keep on sending you distraction after distraction after distraction. If you're a guy, you know, if it's an avera that he can get you to do, he can get you to do an avera, even better. Or if you know he knows that you have walls up, you wouldn't do averas, so he'll send you mutter distractions. Mutter distractions that you need to have in your day also at some point or other. But he'll overload you with distractions, so you keep on saying later, 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 until it's too late. The way to fight the Yetzer is not later, but now. To never stop ourselves in our tracks as soon as we decide later, and do it now. And decide now and how we're going to do it immediately, because otherwise, chances are it won't happen. If you look around the world, and look at yourself, most of the things you pushed off later, they don't end up happening. You have an added challenge in yeshiva that's important to express and to say out, because you've never had this before, probably. Since first grade until last year, as long as you've been being educated, you've been in a system with regular reward and punishment and people monitoring you. You would have report cards, you would have regents, you would have detention, absences, parents who see how you're doing, test grades, report cards. And although we might have hated those systems and been annoyed by our teachers and annoyed by our principals and frustrated from our parents, everything we've accomplished in education, we accomplished because of that whole system. And what brought out wherever we're holding today, the reason why we're not, you know, we're educated is because that system got us to the point that we're at. Because if they just let us, you know, figure it out for ourselves, so we would fill up all of our time with things that are fun, not with things that get us to where we want to get to. In yeshiva, all of a sudden, you're presented with a situation where you're doing the thing that's most important in your entire life, finding and building a connection with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, thinking about meaning and purpose, why am I alive, trying to put ourselves in a track that will keep our lives in a way that will always be connected to something meaningful and purposeful, to face this Torah that we believe in, that our lives are so much affected by, and to learn it and to understand it. And yet, there's so little ramifications, and there's not such a reward and punishment system, and there's so much freedom, that what very commonly happens, and you could ask the Shana Bet guys, you could ask anyone who ever went to any yeshiva or seminary, what very commonly happens is people don't get to do the things that they thought they were going to do, or that they planned on doing. Because since they didn't have that forced structure that they had in schools, and they never decide to take control and be the principal or the teacher or the report card for themselves, so it never ended up happening, and a lot of opportunities slip through fingers, and you find a lot of people that look back at missed opportunities. But we're not in that situation. We're in the beginning of the year, and we could plan on going into the year in a way that we make it. We commit ourselves to a situation where we make sure that we owe it to ourselves that the things that are important to us, that we came here to accomplish, that we right now are dreaming and hoping and aspiring will happen to us, actually end up happening. And that, God forbid, we shouldn't have to make our goals smaller and smaller as the year gets on and the clock ticks away, but that we should keep on actually being inspired and making our goals larger and larger instead of smaller and smaller. There's a Gemara in Shabbos, Chazal and Psukim, when they talk about the lifespan of a person, they usually talk about the number 70 years. That they refer to as an average normal life, and more than that is like a Richos Yamin, extra longevity. So the Gemara in Shabbos points out how if you look at those 70 years of a person, really a person is only alive and accomplishing for 12 years. Because if you subtract all of the hours that we sleep, all the hours that we eat and get dressed and do all the other things in the middle, you end up with 12 years straight. No sleeping, no eating, no anything. 12 years straight of time to accomplish. So I used that same method and I applied it to our year in Israel. How long actually is our year in Israel? So there's officially 129 Torah Traga learning days. In other words, if you subtract out all the Fridays and all the Shabbases, all the vacation days, Sukkot vacation, the Pesach vacation, the trip days, and you just take it out to the bare, the learning, the official structured learning days of Torah Traga, there's 129 of them. Now we're up to 128. Day one is basically over. 128 days left. Every formally part of the schedule, we have 9.5 scheduled hours of Torah Traga learning. If you take morning Seder, afternoon Seder, and night Seder, it adds up to 9.5 hours. If we fully use that time, 9.5 hours a day. If we put all those 9.5 hours a day of 129 days and we smush it all together, we're here for 51 days of no sleeping, no eating, no anything, but 51 days straight. That's a little bit over 7 weeks that we're here for. Every stage in the year, you keep on saying to yourself, what, I'm already here, what? And it gets any Shana Bekai. You can't believe that, well, I'm already here. So you want to catch it early on. You don't want to push it off. Another piece of advice, maybe in the beginning of a year, when I got married, right before I got married, my father-in-law brought me to the Rosh Yeshiva Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yonas and David. And he was giving me advice as a chassan, I'm about to get married. He said, I want you to know something. There's a few times in your life, not many, but a few times in your life where everything's going to change. Everything's going to change. One of those times is when you get married. If you move with your family and pick up and live somewhere else, that's another big type of change in your life. There's a few times in your life where there's a lot changing all at once, where everything is new in your life. You know, in a regular, you know, year, in a regular time of your life, there are things that are hard to get yourself to do because you're in a routine and it's hard to break a routine. It's hard to change a learned behavior. But whenever everything in your life is changing, it's a great time, he said. The very beginning of that time, everything is new anyway. Everything is uncomfortable anyway. You're not used to anything. Throw in a few more things then, because usually you can't change a few things at once. It's hard to change even one thing in your routine. But when you're in the beginning and everything is new, so try to throw in a few more other things that are important to you that you never get around to, and do it then. If there are things, behaviors or actions that you would like to get around to doing, so just know that if enough days or weeks go by that you don't change it here, then you start to build up a new routine here. And it gets just as hard as it was in high school. If there's a way that you speak or the way that you talk to your friends or act with your friends or something within your schedule, something to do with Minyan or whatever it is, that you always want to be better at it, but it's always just so hard. But now, so hard. Everything is unfamiliar to us. Everything is new. So now is a great time to just, you're setting up the beginning of any routine. It's the beginning that's hard. Then it just gets easier. That's also important to know, that it always seems that something new looms very large. That largeness, that difficulty is only in the beginning. Once it's a routine, it's easy. So you may as well start good routines because they all become easy afterwards. Like a Baal Tshuva who, let's say, didn't keep Shabbos and now he starts keeping Shabbos. The beginning was so hard not to turn on the lights. And it just becomes like so obvious, like you don't turn on the lights. It's not even hard for him. But for the rest of his life, he's now accumulating constant reward, closest to Hashem, saving himself from terrible sin, because he built within himself this regular, normal, easy for him now routine of not turning on the lights. That's true with everything in life. Minyan. Whenever everybody's at a stage that they don't go to Minyan, then they do go to Minyan. That switchover point is very hard, but then it's easy. Then it's easy once you do it. Once you do it for a certain number of days straight, and once you in your head it's like a given, this is what I'm going to be doing, then it's easy from then on. So why your whole life let that struggle of a week or two get in your way, that you have to be 80-something and regret that I never got around to dealing with that thing that could have just taken a week or two to fight and get past? Why not start it earlier in life and then move on to something greater and something bigger? I want to say a side point that connects to what I'm talking about now, but really connects to any shmooze and any chizik that you'll hear from any Rebbe in this entire yeshiva, including myself. Whenever we're speaking to a group of people, whenever you're one day speaking to a group of people, so you have this challenge that on the one hand, you can't push them too much, you don't want to turn anybody off, you don't want them to shut you out. On the other hand, if you don't want to tell them too little, because because if you love them and they're listening to you and you're talking to them because you're supposed to try to help them grow, you want to tell them something. And the problem is you have a lot of individuals in front of you, and every individual is a different world. Some people are ready to hear this, some people aren't ready to hear that. Some people can handle this, some people can't. So how do you speak to a group of people? You see them too much. For them it was great, for them it wasn't great. But what do? You try to speak as general as possible, push enough, be light enough. But the rabbi is not going to always know how to measure it exactly the right way. What your job is to do is that when you hear something that's too pressuring or too way over your head, don't get upset with the rabbi or get frustrated with the rabbi or shut him out or not listen to what he's saying anymore because he's expecting too much, he doesn't understand me. Give him a break. He's talking to a few people in his custom. Could be somebody else over here and the custom is very inspired right now. He doesn't know exactly how to measure out his words. So what you need to do, what we all need to do in life, is we have to live on two planes. There's an ideal, and there's where I'm holding. No one, not the greatest gadol in the world, is holding by what their ideal is. There's an ideal of where I'm not holding, what I know is right, what I know is good, what I want to be holding by at one point, and there's where I'm holding right now. And when a person wants to see himself and assumes that, I must be doing the ideal, then he gets messed up in two ways. Either he lowers the ideal, and his ideal is very low, or he's just depressed and frustrated and down all the time because I'm not the ideal guy. To be a normal, healthy way to approach life is to know there's an ideal that I'm never going to be at, and hopefully that will always get higher, and there's where I'm holding it will also always be getting higher. So when you hear a rabbi say something, so it might not fit into where you're holding, it might be too above that, but to see it as, but for some people it could apply, and for one person, and even if I don't know if I'll ever be holding there, but take it for what it is, and you figure out how it could apply to you, or talk to the Rebbe separately afterwards, and ask your Rebbe, how would that apply to me, because I feel like I can't do what you're saying. But don't reject the things that you hear when it's not on your level, because try to figure out how it could apply to me, and often you'll need to speak to the Rebbe himself or another Rebbe and ask, how could I apply this to me? How could I grow from it? Maybe I'll just say a few more words about shofar, because I have this guilty feeling of, for thousands of years, in Elul, if there's a Mashkiach of Yeshiva, the Mashkiach has to say the word Elul in the Shmuz in Elul. You cannot say the word Elul. You have to talk about Elul. And we're in Elul. And it's frustrating because usually, as I was saying to the Shana Bet guys yesterday, that the way it works out with the American calendar is that, what's Elul? When you finish camp, when you pack up, and then you come to Israel and you start school, it's the first week or two of school, so just Elul slips right through your fingers and you don't actually know what Elul is or experience in Elul. When you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you see that they put different things into the halacha system that are different than the other months of the year. The Sfardim have been saying Slichos already. Ashkenazim were blowing shofar, were saying the David Hashem. So it's not just, the halacha is not there because, we need to blow shofar during Elul. We need to say the David. It's because these are different days. When you look in Chazal, they say this is a time of preparation. It's a time of preparing for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Often you stand on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and it's like uncomfortable. You don't know what to do. There's no comfort. But really, there's a whole month of Elul that we're meant to be preparing, that we should be ready and understand what Rosh Hashanah is when Rosh Hashanah comes, what Yom Kippur is when Yom Kippur comes. What is that shofar that's blowing every single morning? What's going on over there? I'm sure there's so much that could be said about shofar. One nice idea that I heard is back in the Torah and maybe up until, 100-something years ago, so there was no electricity. And whenever there was a major emergency announcement that would need to be made, you had a guy blowing a siren, blowing a shofar, standing on the walls of the city. If the enemy army is coming, if there's a fire that's spreading, if there's some type of impending danger or concern, so they would blow a shofar that everybody should know. When the army is now ready to go forward and fight, they blow the shofar. Chazal say, living in Israel, so a lot of those that were here last summer and previous years in Israel, so we've lived through sirens, where there's a siren that there's some type of a threat coming into our airspace that might blow up somewhere, and everyone, the percentage of the danger they're in goes up. And the siren goes off, and it's very scary, much scarier than, they don't have a little announcement before saying, this is just a test, it doesn't apply to Gris, it only applies to Rosh Hashanah. No, it's like suddenly you hear a siren, that, and it's made psychologically that it should make your heart thump and make you move. They don't want people to be calm and stay in their places. They want you to move. They want you to go to bomb shelters. If you were to, you know, be in the street when this is going off and see somebody, you know, sitting and playing a game, you're like, hello, there's a siren. You got to go. You got to go into the bomb shelter. You have to wake up. So that was what the shofar always elicited. When they would blow the shofar in Elo, it's an arousal. It wakes you up that, whoa, wait. I always thought to myself, I don't know if I should say this, I'm going to say it anyway. I always thought, I can't picture it. What happens in all those clubs? Sorry, I'm just going to do this. What happens in a club that they're doing whatever they do there, and a siren goes off, they all run to, I imagine they run to bomb shelters, and then what? When the siren's over, you just go back and like start again. Like, I don't know, like, it's a weird, I don't know. like when you hear a siren, you're like, you're shooken up. Like, my life's in danger. I want to live, you know. Okay, I can live. Okay. Well, I don't know what they do exactly. I'm not sure how it works. But a siren or chauffeur is supposed to, like, shake you up and make you focus in. That, wait, you know, listen up. Wake up. Chazal say there's a shofar blowing at the time of Tchiyas HaMeisim. You know that when the king is coming, they blow the shofar. So they blow the shofar in Elul, the king is coming, Kadosh Baruch Hu is coming. We're trying to think different things that all these shofar blowings have in common. And one of them is that when you hear a shofar blowing, you can't think of anything else. Tchiyas HaMeisim, I'm going to see my grandfather, I'm going to see my grandmother, I'm going to see my great-grandmother, I'm going to see this, I'm going to see... You can't think of anything else now. You just want to find that mace. When there's a war coming, I can't relax right now. I can't think right now. I can only think about that there's a war right now. And even there's something I could do to contribute to it. It's all I can think about. It captures my mind completely. They don't just blow a shofar once on Rosh Hashanah. They're blowing it throughout the month of Elul, and they're trying to get someone's attention. And many people will go to shul in the morning, hear a shofar, go, you know, whatever. But at least when we're in yeshiva, we want to learn how to listen to a shofar and have the shofar wake us up a little bit and think a little bit. They're waking someone up. Let it be us. Let it wake us up. Let's hear the shofar. So the shofar is trying, I think, to fight a little bit what we were discussing before. You're pushing off later. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, later. And the shofar is saying, now. Wake up now. Focus in. Don't push it off. Make it happen now. How that could apply to each and every person, everyone will apply that to themselves. Maybe I'll end off with one last thing and then we'll go to Night Seder. There's a pasuk in Tehillim that says, "Kechitzim biyad hagibur, kein b'nei ha'ne'urim." That just like an arrow in the hand of an archer, so too are the days of youth. They compare the days that a person is young to an arrow in the hands of an archer. Well, what's the comparison over there? So I heard a few pshats. One of them is that when you're shooting an arrow, so from your perspective, if you look down at that arrow, so a little bit that way, it looks like it doesn't make any difference at all. Who really cares? A 0.001, you know, degree of a difference doesn't make a difference. But where the arrow ends up hitting down the line, it's very, very different. When you're shooting an arrow, all the power of it is in the beginning. You can't run after an arrow and get it back. All the energy is right there in the beginning. A youth, when we're younger, the decisions that we make, and young people, we don't feel like we, I don't know if I'm young or not, but young people, we don't realize how far reaching the smallest of their decisions are. When you're 30, when you're 40, when you're 50, you look back at things that you decided accidentally, or didn't even decide, just happened, from the ages of 18 to 22, 23, and you realize, oh my gosh, those things made my life. So much of my life is built on things that I either randomly decided or just fell into between those ages, and it's so much harder and very rare to make big changes later on. So it's important to know when we're younger that these days, the smallest of things have the largest far-reaching ramifications. We have to be thinking about our grandchildren right now with the smallest of decisions. And to know that it's much harder later on in life to make things happen. Earlier on is the best time to do it. We shall be to focus in on doing things now. So right now...